Hello everyone, and welcome back to Mountain Talk with Sioux City Explorers Manager Steve Montgomery. Mountain Talk is a weekly program that gives you, the fans, the opportunity to ask the Sioux City Manager questions about the Explorers, baseball or sports in general, or just seek Steve's wisdom about life events that are going on out there. In this week's episode, Steve talks to us about the return of Nate Sampson. He tells us what it was like to coach under Doug Semenek. And is there such a thing as too many cats? Let's find out on Mountain Talk.
So let's welcome back Manager Steve Montgomery. Steve, do you first of all have team updates for us?
Not much has happened since last time we talked. You know, the only thing that's happened is that we have moved another player back to MLB, and that's Kevin McKenna. He's going to join the Arizona Diamondbacks organization. We're very happy for Kevin. It creates a hole, obviously, in your pitching rotation and stuff. But we've had other players step up, and, you know, we have a guy who isn't under contract, but he's flying in today, and that'll get us up to 10 pitchers, and we're currently looking to add one or two more arms.
How many guys is that for you that your team has had signed to affiliate ball this season then?
Well, since the beginning of the year, we had signed a second baseman. First we moved Rainier Robal back to the Los Angeles Dodgers in January, and then we had signed a second baseman by the name of Nelson Ward, who then was picked up by the Seattle Mariners, and then Kurt Heyer we had signed, and then he was picked up by the Marlins, and then subsequently released by the Marlins, and then we got him back, so I don't know if you count that. And then during the season, it's been John Nogowski, James Needy, and Kevin McKenna now, so three during the season, and, you know, subsequently six since the beginning of the year. So, you know, great for the players. I always say great for them. You know, bad for us because they're not coming after the guys that are struggling. They're coming after the guys that are doing their jobs. So it's just our job to find another guy to do their job.
It shows that you're a pretty good observer of talent, I would say, though.
Yeah, we've been able to get the players in here, and a little bit of the reason why we've been able to get the players is because of the sheer amount of players we have been moving over the course of the last 2-3 years. You know, we've had a high number of players move back, and you know, obviously we're selling that to the players when they're released. That, you know, if you look at our numbers, people are coming after our guys, and if you come here, you got a shot.
That's awesome. Well, one guy I wanted to ask you about was you had talked a little bit about Nate Sampson coming off the disabled list on the 9th. Is that looking like that's where he's going to be at, and is he ready to play?
Well, he's eligible to come off the second day in Cleburne, which I think is the 8th, or because there's 31 days in July, so I was off by a day. You know, I don't know if he's going to be able to come off then. We just had a follow-up visit the other day. It's healing, but the bridge has not formed yet with the over top of the break to kind of protect that actual break. Once the bridge forms, you can play, but if you would take a ball or something on there, you have a chance of re-breaking it worse. But you know, Nate's a very, you know, this is the only time in Nate's career he's ever missed games due to injury, and it's really wearing on him. So we're gonna reevaluate him next Wednesday and see if the bridge has formed, and if it has formed, we can bring him off have him for the Lincoln series that starts next Thursday.
Now, this is kind of a tough week for you guys because of how many games you've had in such a short period of time with just 9 or 10 guys on the pitching staff. I'm thinking this is really kind of straining on the team.
Absolutely, absolutely. We had at one point we had one guy available in the pen. Last Monday we asked our closer to pitch 2 2/3 innings, something we're not accustomed to doing. But, when Kevin was purchased last Monday, he was the scheduled starter that night. So that even hurt us even more because, you had to spot start a bullpen guy. So, you know, hopefully the guy that's coming in, young guy, hopefully can come in and make 4 or 5 starts for us down the stretch and prove himself worthy to be in this league. And, you know, someone we're looking for, not only this year, but possibly for next year as well.
Now, you welcomed Wichita to town this weekend. Last night, you guys had a big dramatic victory over them. What are some of the challenges that a team like that poses for you?
Well, they know the league. I think up and down, it's probably one of the more experienced lineups for this league, in the league. So, you know, you look at like a lineup like us. We have Washington in the league. Who's been in the league? Lang's been in the league. And Vavra. Those are, you know, with the lineup we put out last night, those are the only guys that were in the league. If you look up and down them, Sullivan's new to the league, but Stringer was here last year, Cleveland, Mittelstadt, Chavez, Medino, Prigatano, Salgado, and Vargas. They were all there last year. So they understand the type of ball that Pete wants to play. They understand what it takes to win. They understand what the umpires are going to call and what they're not going to call. So they pose a threat that way. Their pitching staff, they don't walk guys. They come right after you, and they come after you hard. They come after you with fastballs, and you don't see that too often in this league. So, you know, the middle of their order is as good as anybody in the league with Cleveland, Mittelstadt, and Chavez, and Medina, and Stringer in the two hole. So they definitely have what it takes to make a run. You know, they have good starting pitching. They won it out of the bullpen. And, you know, they're one of the teams that carry 23 guys, and I always think that's beneficial.
Well, let's head to fan questions this week. We first of all begin with James from Sioux City. He says, were you consulted in any way before the league postponed that game against Winnipeg, or was that just made without any input from the Explorers at all?
Well, I was notified at about 3:30 in the afternoon. I was sitting in my office getting ready to go out for BP. My general manager, Shane Tritz, walked in and said the game's been canceled. And I said, what? I said, are you kidding me? What's going on? And he explained that they were sick. And I said, well, you know, we have guys that are sick up in Winnipeg, and we have guys that can't get in the border, but we still have to play the games. So I guess how it went down is that somebody was consulted, or Rick or Sam had called the league and notified them that they were sick, and I guess they reached out to Shane, and then there was some back and forth calling. I don't know what all the details was, but you know, the league had decided that either that they didn't have enough players, or the players they had they weren't going to put out there. I don't know the exact details, but I was notified at 3:30 in the afternoon, and I was pretty livid at the time, because you look at, we were playing pretty good baseball at that point. We had taken both games of the series, and we had scored double-digit runs in both games. So we had a lot of confidence going into that game, a lot of confidence as a team. And I knew by the time that game was going to be made up in August that our team – would probably be different, because I felt like some guys were going to get picked up. So, and, you know, sure enough, that's what happened.
Understandable. Becky from Dakota City would like to say, Mongo, I just wanted to say kudos for you guys for having class to play that game against Winnipeg when they showed none and getting it canceled in the first place.
Well, I mean, I don't think it comes down to class. I think it just comes down to, you know, the league maybe just decided that it wasn't, you know, that they didn't have enough players. Or, you know, like I said, I don't know the entire situation. I've always been under the assumption that you figure out a way to play the games. You know, I think they could have, you know, I'll say scrounged up nine players. And the one thing that's I felt that could have been done is, instead of canceling a whole game, maybe call the managers, maybe text the managers as a group and say, listen, we're in a situation where Sioux City's playing Winnipeg. Winnipeg needs some bodies. You know, they could have called some college kids that didn't get drafted around here, maybe signed them for a day contract, but not make them put some guys on the disabled list per se. Just, you know, they're sick, and just let them sign a few guys so that we still could have played the game. I think the games are important. You know, these owners, our owners in our league, only have 50 home games to make their gates to do, you know, to watch their team play. So that's why I think it's so important that we, you know, we play all 50 home games and all 50 road games, so that the owners get to, you know, make their money and see their team play.
I couldn't agree with you more. Craig from South Sioux City, excuse me, would like to know, he says, what does standing at different places on the rubber do for you as a pitcher, or is that just more about comfort?
It changes the angle of what the pitch does and how the hitter sees the pitch. I'm a big proponent of, you know, a guy who's a right-handed hitter standing on the right side of the rubber when he's facing right-handed hitters. And when he's facing left-handed hitters, you know, most of the time you're going to work them away. Maybe you bust them in. But, you know, if you're a low three-quarter guy and you're standing on the right side of the rubber facing a right-handed hitter, you can physically start the breaking ball right at them, which will just give them that split second of maybe, uh-oh. And then by that time, if they say, uh-oh, they're beat with that pitch. So I'm a big proponent of doing that. Now, I have heard of organizations, sinker ballers, guys who run the ball a lot arm side, of moving the guys to the left-hand side of the rubber being right-handed so that they have more plate to work with. But the biggest thing is it does change angles of pitches and it changes angles for hitters.
Sean from Martinsburg would like to know, are you a preferer of grass or turf?
Uh-huh. You know, I obviously the game I think has it was made to be played on natural grass. There's something beautiful about a field that has designs in it, and you you look from above and you see that pattern the grounds crew has created. So I do like that. On the flip side, with the way turf has gone and how turf has evolved over the course of the last 5-10 years, you know, the turf plays just like natural grass now. And, you know, it can save, obviously, the cost of turf up front is pretty significant, but the amount of games you probably save and the amount of product when it rains, you know, you're dumping 15, 20 bags of turfus. What's that cost you plus the manpower plus, you know, turf, there's really nothing you have to do except just watch it rain and just watch the water fall. So, you know, I think in the long run, you'll see a lot of fields just going to turf, but there's something about natural grass for me.
Lisa from Emerson asks, who has been your favorite player you have ever coached or managed?
Wow, that's a good question. I've had a lot. You know, going back to the old days of Fargo being a pitching coach, obviously Todd George stands out for me, a guy who wanted the ball. We called him Big Game Todd George because he pitched so many big games for us and just seemed to come through in those situations. You know, one of the better offensive players I ever coached, and, you know, I just threw him BP, was a third baseman by the name of Eric Campbell. He was a double-A player, came to Fargo. There wasn't much I didn't see that guy do. Very, very good player. As far as the managing side, obviously Nate Sampson. Nate's done so much for this team and this organization. And another one that stands out is Rob Wirt. Rob took the ball in any situation. You know, I can recall him taking the ball in the fifth inning of game one of the, I call it the Super Series between St. Paul and Sioux City in 2015. He took the ball in the sixth inning, pitched like 3 1/3, 4 1/3 innings, whatever it was. And then 3 days later took the ball for another 3 innings. So, you know, as a manager, definitely Rob and Nate, and, you know, I love, you know, I don't like to play favorites, but I mean, Tony Campana, what he brings to this team, the energy he brings, and you know, you see how fast he is on the field. He's that fast in the clubhouse too. He is just high energy. I don't know what he eats, but I need to get on that diet so that I have that much energy.
If you find out, that would be great. I'd like that too. Owen from Sioux City asks, what is it like to be a coach for Doug Semenek? He seems like a terse guy to me.
Well, it's hard. There's no doubt about it. He's hard. He's hard on his coaches. I remember the first thing that Doug Semenik ever told me, because everyone's got to realize that I was a player in 2003, turned pitching coach in 2004. So we had probably seven or eight guys that I was teammates with that were still on the team, you know, and all of a sudden I'm their coach. So I remember Doug saying, you know, if I ever catch you out with the players, you're done. And I've kind of stuck with that mentality. There has to be a line between coach and player. And, you know, he's hard to work for, but I'll tell you what, there is no one more fun to be around than Doug Semenik. He, even though on the field he looks tense, he looks, you know, he's in your face, he's brash, that's all Doug Semenik. But as far as him and me and, you know, the relationship we had, it was strained when I left a little bit, you know, to take the Sioux City job, but we've kind of reconciled over the past year and a half, we've kind of reconciled it up. He's a great mentor for me, and, you know, he's a fun guy to be around, even though on the field, he's all about winning. That's all he is. That's it. It's win the game and then, you know, let's have fun. And, you know, a lot of people won't believe it, but, you know, if I was in a pinch for anything and I called Doug, I think Doug and his wife, Stephanie, would help me out in a heartbeat.
Bill from Sioux City would like to know, when you play 100 games in a season, are you able to handle losses a little more easily?
No. I'm the ultimate competitor. I've said it before. If I'm playing my kids at Monopoly, if they look the other way, maybe I take a card that I need and stuff. So, I like to win. I've always been like that. I'm ultra competitive. I've been like that since I've been 4 or 5 years old. And, you know, I think that I've instilled that in my kids. My kids are ultra competitive amongst each other at home. And then when they step on a baseball field, they're ultra competitive as well. When you have 100 games, yes, you know you're going to lose. You know it's not going to be the smoothest of times, especially in independent ball when your team can be dismantled within 2 or 3 days with major league organizations or injuries, like we've had happen this year. You know, in back-to-back games, we lose our 5 and 3 hole hitters. And then, you know, you're missing your 4 who went to the Cardinals, and your 6 is still with a fractured hand. So in a matter of 2 days or a week and a half, I had 3 through 7 or 3 through 5 in my lineup gone and my 7-hole hitter. So losing is not something I like to do, but you have to accept it and move on. And I think if you look in the rearview mirror and dwell on the losses of the past, then you're not giving everything to your team to help your team win that game today.
Because of things like that, do you find that the way that you address the team changes? Because like I think if I was a major league manager, let's just say, and the team isn't performing, you know, you can kind of get down on them and say, you know, you guys need to shape up or you're out of here. But when you're losing guys because they're advancing on and you have injuries and things like that, do you wind up having to change your own attitude about that towards the team just because there's nothing that they can do?
Well, I think that you need to change your style a little bit more. You know, what I mean by that is that, you know, maybe you sack bunt a little bit more just to get guys into positions where they can just put the ball in play and, you know, get an RBI and get them some confidence and such. But it's definitely a challenge, especially when you lose guys that are producing. It's not like, you know, it's not like we lost our 8 and 9 hole hitters, you know. You know, you can go out, and if you have a defensive specialist, let's say at shortstop, you can go out and you can replace a guy like that. But, you know, there's no Nate Sampson's laying around. There's no John Nagowski's laying around. They're not laying around looking for work. Those type of players are playing already, and, you know, those are guys that are really irreplaceable in a lineup. You try to plug guys in, but they're not going to give you the same production that a guy like that does.
I think people forget, too, is when the all-star shortstop for Houston goes down, they got a big farm system to go replace that, and you are trying to go find somebody somewhere.
Right. And what happens is that, you know, you have Nate Sampson, and I say it all the time, you have Nate Sampson in the hopper. So you have him, he's yours. So every shortstop that gets released, yes, that's a good player you look at, and you say, okay, could he play second or could he play third? And you look at his career, you make your calls and everything. But ultimately, if he's a shortstop and you call him up, he's going to want to play shortstop. Well, you already have Nate Sampson playing there, so you move on to the next guy. So you pass on a lot of these guys, and then all of a sudden on July 6th or 7th, you know, Nate gets injured, and now you go out and you try to find a shortstop in the free world, and it's just not available, especially one of the caliber of Nate Sampson.
Wow. Brian from Sioux City would like to know, he says he would think that you can't argue every bad call that umpires make, so how do you decide when to come out?
Well, I think you pick and choose your battles. You know, if it's a guy that, you know, you never lose sight of how many calls a guy blows for you or does this or does that for you. You keep like a running tally in your mind. So, and then obviously when you, at an important time in the game that your team maybe needs a kickstart or you've been playing poorly over the course of, you know, the last 72 hours, 3 days or something, you go over there and you make your point, and you gotta let your team know that you have their back, because they go out on a daily basis and put it out on the field on a nightly basis for you. So I think it's important that you have their back, but ultimately it comes down to each umpire, and to be honest with you, there's some umpires in the league you trust more than you trust others. So if it's one you really trust, you can maybe run over there and go, hey, I got him safe, or blah, blah, blah. But if this one you don't trust, you go over there and you might get a little hot and heated in a hurry. So I just think you pick and choose, and, you know, I think it's according to how your team's playing.
You said something in there that I'd like to ask you about, because somebody had asked a question I saw recently. They had heard that Malcolm Cameron, the coach of the Wichita Thunder, was talking about how fighting can really kind of get a team hyped up. Does arguing with an umpire have that same kind of effect?
I think so. I think that just lets your team know that how competitive you are as a manager, and how you have their back. Now, you can flip it and say when you get kicked out, you're hurting your team because, you know, the main guy in the operation is going into the locker room and can't come back out. Yes, I think that's a valid argument as well. But, you know, when your team knows that the manager wants to win, the manager, you know, has your back, the manager is going to do everything in his power, not let you just consistently, get bad calls against you, I think there's something to be said about that.
Tom from Riverside would like to know, he says, watching the Cubs struggling this season after winning the World Series, he's wondering how hard it is for your team a year after winning 75 games.
I think it was more hard on the coaching staff than it was the players, because we didn't have, off of that 75-win season, you know, we had Tommy Mendoza back. Our shortstop was back, Noah, but we had moved him to first. We had plugged in Nate Sampson. Ryan Cord had gotten picked up. We put Jarrett Cunningham there. The outfield, Matty Johnson was here, Lang was here, and Caldwell. And then Matty had some personal issues that he had to leave the team, and, you know, we plugged in. So, you know, and then the pitching staff was all revamped. I don't think we had anybody back other than Ryan Zimmerman. So there wasn't a lot of pieces that per se were with the 75 wins, but yeah, that you can see with the Cubs, all those players were there for the World Series run, and you can have a little bit of a hangover, and you just go out there and you go about your paces, and you're expected to win, and the next thing you know, I think you get that mentality, oh, we lost this one, we'll just win tomorrow, and then next thing you know, you're sitting around 500 80 or 90 games into the year. But since the All-Star break, I saw on SportsCenter the other day, they were like 13-3 the time I saw them. I don't know what they've done over the course of the last 48 hours. But, you know, they got it going now. And, Yeah, you expect them to be there. They got all the pieces offensively, top to bottom through the lineup. They're dynamic. They hit for power. They play in a small ballpark, and their starting pitching's pretty good, and their bullpen's not bad either. So you expect them to be there in the end, and at least in the NL Championship Series, which, you know, I think everybody wants to see a Cubs-Dodgers NLCS. I think you would have a lot of fireworks, and it'd be a great series to watch.
Connor from Sioux City would like to know, as you find that the team is slowly creeping out of contention, does that give you the opportunity to try new things as a manager just to see how effective they would be?
Well, the guys in this locker room still believe they're in contention, so we have to, as a coaching staff, until you're mathematically eliminated, try to go out there. But yeah, you look at it, and on any given night, two teams ahead of you could be playing. So the best case scenario for you in a four-game series is for, you know, to go 2-2, or one team wins four and the other team doesn't win four. But the problem would be in that situation, like last night, we're three games, Kansas City's three games back, and I think we're 11 games back of Lincoln. Well, if Kansas City wins that game, yes, you go 10 games back of the division, but you're still three games back of the wild card. And then you got Winnipeg and Fargo and St. Paul up there. Fargo's playing St. Paul, so one of them's going to be winning and one of them's going to be losing. And you have Winnipeg and Gary playing, so one of them's winning and one of them's losing. So it's very, very difficult to jump multiple teams in a race. It has to be a perfect storm. And, you know, I don't know if we have enough games to do it, but we're going to give it one hell of a try.
Trevor from Sioux City would like to know, he says, why don't they ever play walk-up music when the managers come out to hand in the lineup card? I would think that Bad to the Bone would be the perfect choice for you.
You know, it's funny you say that because in 95, when I was in Johnstown, they made a shirt, and my setup guy, a guy by the name of Denny McLean, and not the Denny McLean that won all them games, some Denny McLean for Detroit did something, maybe 30 wins or something like that.
Yeah, I think 31,
yeah. You know, he came out to Wild Thing, and I came out to Bad to the Bone. So what they did was that they made like one of those character T-shirts where they draw pictures of you and stuff, and they put it on a T-shirt, and I actually have one of those T-shirts left. It's actually, we framed it and we put it in my son's room, who's all dedicated to kind of baseball and stuff. And it actually says Steve Montgomery, Bad to the Bone underneath it. So it's kind of ironic that you mentioned that. But yeah, I mean, we don't get caught up in the walk up. I don't even pay attention to the music, really. I'm more of the old school guy. I like the guy playing on the piano and kind of that old school ballpark music.
That is awesome. Look at Trevor, but didn't know you were Bad to the Bone like that, so that's pretty cool. We have a couple of questions from Jim. The first one is, he says, I like your thoughts on the Hall of Fame. I think it is ridiculous that the all-time hits leader, the all-time home run leader, and the guy who has the most Cy Young awards are all out of the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, just make a separate wing for it. And, you know, just call it, the steroid era of baseball. I think, like I said, I think there was something going on every single, you know, decade or 20 years, whatever you want to say, that just was swept under the rug. But, you know, the thing about it is now is that media is so intense. I mean, you just look at the coverage we get. I mean, we have three or four managers doing shows with you. We have you do a great job of covering the American Association, and you know, that's not even on top of what each team is doing, the league is doing, what certain writers are doing. So, and we're just talking about independent baseball. At the major league level, I mean, you just think of the coverage they're getting. I mean, you're not going to be able to do anything without somebody finding out what you're doing. So just put them in the Hall of Fame, put them in a separate wing, but they deserve to be there.
Jim would also like to know, if you think there will be a time where independent managers are recognized and inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think that you know, independent ball is getting a lot more looks now from Major League Baseball than maybe, you know, 5-10 years ago. Just for say, I think the talent level has risen immensely in independent ball. I can remember being back way back when, and you had a guy throwing 90 miles an hour. He was one of the harder throwers in the league. I mean, now we got guys approaching triple digits in independent ball. So, you know, they're Major League Baseball and the Hall of Fame. You know, I don't think you'll ever, maybe ever, see an independent manager get into the Hall of Fame just because, you know, it's not associated with Major League Baseball. I think if Major League Baseball ever took over independent ball and made it like a permanent feeding ground that Major League Baseball endorsed and stuff like that, you might see that happen. But as long as Major League Baseball isn't particularly involved with hands-on day-to-day operations with it, I don't think you'll see an independent manager in the Hall of Fame.
Next up, we have Cam, who says, you live in Florida, so what's the deal with the Jacksonville Jaguars? How come they always stink?
I'm not a big NFL guy. You know, I follow a little bit of the Cleveland Browns, but Jacksonville has one of the richer owners I know in the league. I believe he's from overseas, or maybe he lives here now, but he was from overseas. He's got a foreign name. They got Blake Bortles, I think, as quarterback. They made him a high-round pick. He was out of, I believe, Central Florida. And, you know, you got to draft well. I mean, that's the most important part of the NFL, and I think you got to build it from the inside out. And what I mean by that is that the temptations of taking quarterbacks so early in the draft, my team, for example, I mean, we've taken, like, 5 quarterbacks in the last 10 years or 15, 20 years in the first round. And not one of them has panned out. You have Tim Couch. You got the guy from Texas A&M that
Johnny
was a
Manziel.
Trainer.
Yeah.
Johnny Manziel. We had Tim Couch. We had, and there's someone else in there too. And then we just brought RG3 in. So we're a train wreck at quarterback. But I think if you build from the defensive line and the offensive line out, you can have something there, because I mean, I can't name the last time a New England Patriot. You can't even name really their three wide receivers. They're just no names that other teams just drop, but they come in and they're put into a system, and you know they have one of the better quarterbacks in the league throwing the ball to them. But I think if you just build from the inside out, they're you should be pretty good, and I don't think Jacksonville's done that.
So are you a big Hugh Jackson fan that he got hired as their coach?
No. Like I said, I'm not really a big NFL guy. I would rather watch college football. Call me crazy. But I got a theory on the NFL. The first 3 weeks really doesn't count. The next 3 weeks, they're sort of getting warmed up. And by week 8 or 9, they're playing. But, you know, early on in the season, I just watched those first couple NFL games. And it's just kind of like, I don't want to call it slow motion, but there's just not a lot of passion there. It's more looks like a job, like work. And, you know, I look at the college season, and granted, some of the early games are blowout games because teams don't play anybody. But, you know, I'm a huge Ohio State fan, and they got Oklahoma, I think, in week 2. So it should be a good matchup, and I'm looking forward to that game. But on Sundays, I don't really watch too much NFL.
Our next question comes from a person who chose not to identify himself. He says, my wife asked me why I didn't do something the way she asked. I explained my reasoning, and she told me I was mansplaining. Because I am a man, my reasoning is ridiculous. And then he gave me grr with a whole lot of R's to it.
Well, I you know, it's happy wife, happy life is what I always like to say. And, you know, I always, you know, I don't do things like the way my wife wants them done all the time. And, you know, I always say, well, if you want it done the way you want it done, then you do it the way you want to do it. And, we're not going to be perfect. We sometimes men think outside the box where, you know, we're looking for a shortcut. Let's just be honest. If we got something that needs to be done in the yard, we're not going to sit out there and figure it and do it the long way. We're going to figure out how to do it quick. And because there's a sporting event we want to watch on TV. So, you know, if you just try to do it the way your wife wants it, but when she's not looking, just kind of do it the way you want to do it and get it done. And that's the most important part. I think no matter how the situations are, husband and wife, you know, come to an agreement, get the situation done, and just move forward.
Our last question this week comes from a very irritated Tyler from Burbank who would like to know, how many cats is too many?
One. I am not whatsoever a cat guy. I don't get cats. I have three dogs, but the cats, I had a cat growing up, and the funny thing, his name is Tom. And we had it from when I was about 8 till I was about 12. And then he subsequently got hit with a snowplow. And but he was a cat that would run around the neighborhood and do his thing and then come back. But this cat would just be like the most lovable cat. And he would jump up on the couch and he would lay next to you and he would be purring. And the next thing you know, he would just turn into the devil. And he would just claw you and whack you a couple times and then run off. So I'm just like, since I've been 8 or 12 years old, I'm not a cat person at all, and I just think that most of them are possessed.
Wow. Well, thanks for joining us this week, Steve.
All right, I appreciate it.
We want to thank Manager Steve Montgomery for joining us on Mountain Talk this week. If you have your own questions you'd like to ask the Sioux City Explorers Manager, please send them to us at asksteve@minorleaguesportsupport.com. That's asksteve@minorleaguesportsupport.com. Please have your questions to us by Wednesday evening so we can give Steve a little time to review them before we record the show. I'm Rob Pinier, the Managing Editor of the Minor League Sports Report. We'll see you next time on Mountain Talk.